any of the printers to work this morning, so I'm having technical difficulties. We'll see if I can switch between my notes and my some of my class notes, and we'll see if I remember. But I want to remember some announcements I had, which were that. Let's see. First of all, I'm just slowly grading all the assignments. Kind of, I've graded like part of number four, I've graded part of number two, and I'm a little bit reliant upon my secretary. I hand her a batch, and then she puts them in, and she only works 2 days a week. She's very slow. I apologize for that. I'm trying to get them back to you as quickly as I can, and you'll see that I'm spending a lot of time kind of giving a lot of information and comments on them. The other thing I wanted to tell you guys is that tomorrow at 5:30 p.m., in room 505, which is kind of this little seminar room right next to the elevators on the fifth floor, we're having an info session for anyone who's interested in the environmental law program and any of the classes that are being offered in the environmental law program. That also includes the moot court. That's the environmental law moot court, and it includes the study abroad programs to Israel and Morocco that happen next semester. Let's see. What can I tell you? You guys, I know I've already, like, very eagerly looked at what I'm teaching next semester and can't wait to sign up. Yeah, all right. So next semester I'm teaching natural resources law. There's a lot of kind of intersections between this class and natural resources law. There's a lot that has to do with kind of property and land ownership, but also ownership of water, minerals, and all those other different fun things. I am also teaching federal Indian law, which surprisingly actually does have a lot of intersections with property law, con law, history. That class is only taught every other year, so if you are interested in it at all, you need to sign up for next semester. If you're interested in the moot court, there's also a Native American moot court competition. I'm the coach for that one as well as the environmental one. You also need to take that class. What else can I tell you? Oh, I'm teaching a lot next semester. I'm also teaching the climate change class. The climate change class comes in two varieties. One is that you can take a one-unit version of the class, and it's just for block two, which is, I guess, the month of October. Meets four times, and you get a little kind of nitty-gritty, what is climate change all about? What are the kind of big legal ideas behind it? And then if you take the three-unit version of the class, which is by application, then you come with me to Morocco, and we attend the climate change negotiations. We went for the first time last year, and it was in Paris last year, and the six students went had an awesome time. And if anybody's interested, I can tell you more. You can help. I'll tell you how to track them down to ask for more questions. I'm also kind of actually teaching a small one-unit class that's block three. I'm going to be co-teaching that with an attorney from Hodgson Russ that is going to be about a yet-to-be-chosen environmental law statute, just taking one of the major environmental laws, like the Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act. My guess is going to be the Safe Drinking Water Act, and just looking, getting like the nitty-gritty, a little bit more in-depth about one of the statutes and how they work. It's a really good class. Anybody who's just interested in statutes generally, if you're planning on going into an area of law, even if it's not environmental, right? There's nobody here who's interested in environmental. Is that true? Maybe. It's like the first year that nobody didn't have that like all over their card, like yay trees. Learning about statutes is very good for anybody who's interested in any kind of statute-based area of law. So that includes immigration, tax, labor. There's a few areas of law that are very statute-based, which is kind of funny because in this class it's all common law-based, but most of what I do involves looking actually at big federal statutes and how they work and how we interpret them. Other than the fact that we're going to start entering into kind of the realm of property law where I do my most of my research, which is the realm of private land use planning and easements. We'll get to second half today. All right. Those are my announcements. Any questions, Charlotte?
Time and place.
Say it again. Time and place for the meeting. Yeah, it's 5:30 tomorrow in room 505, which I think there's a room number on that, but it is on the fifth floor right next to the elevators. There's like a little seminar room right there. Ian?
Just a random question, but I'm just curious. Do you work with Kenneth Shockley? Because I see he's doing an environmental
classes. I do.
Okay. There's like overlap. It just seems so close, but I feel like it's not known about what they do. That you guys do similar.
Yes, I know Ken quite well. There's a lot of it's always this tricky thing in the law school, or I guess in any program, but particularly once we enter graduate school. I actually think more of the law school than other departments. We become really kind of like, we only look at the law school list of classes for ideas of what we might be interested in doing and where we go. But there's a whole universe out there, at least a whole university out there. And so if you're interested, for example, in environmental law, there's classes you can take in philosophy and in planning and geography and things like that, including Ken Shockley's classes. Yes? Yeah? All right. Okay, let's see. All right, so we are going to finish up our last little part of landlord-tenant law. I'm hoping maybe I can... I'll put some slides up for you in a minute. I just wouldn't want to forget my beginning stuff. So we've done most of the substance of landlord-tenant law, about the obligations that the two parties owe each other, the lessor-lessee relationship. And the last little part that I want to end with is making sure we understand the special category of subleases and assignments that becomes particularly tricky and that we see surprisingly frequently occurring. So let me see now if I can go to our projector. Maybe. We'll see. All right. All right, so subleases and assignments. Subleases and assignments are very kind of a similar idea, which is actually what gets them to, we can become kind of tricky, right? Because they're so similar, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between the two of them. And there is a significant legal difference based on the obligations that the parties owe each other and who's responsible for them. All right. Anybody? Let me tell you, the way that subleases and assignments, we think of them... I mean, people think of them in residential context, but the most common context we see them in is in the commercial context. Anybody in this room ever wanted to open a business other than a law firm? James, what business?
Like a design firm.
A design firm. What are you going to design?
Interiors.
Okay. All right, interior design firm. James is starting a business. It's an interior design firm. How many employees are you going to have?
Four.
Four employees. it's all planned out already. He's got four employees, interior design firm. He's going to go and rent a place to do that. Now, most businesses, particularly starting out, start out by renting, right? He's not quite sure where his business is going. He's not sure how quickly it's going to grow, what kind of space he's going to need. So he's going to start out by renting that area, by leasing it, instead of going out and buying a building. That is the most common way that a business starts. All right, who's your landlord? Anybody willing to rent to James? All right, Jamie's the only one willing to rent to James. Francis might be willing to enter into this agreement. Okay. All right, so there's a couple things that could happen to James now with his business. One, it's like wildly popular. And they just like everybody wants to hire them. And his four employees are there's just not enough. He needs to hire like four more. There's 8 of them and they're pretty cramped in this space. So James is gonna want to move on and find another space. But he's got this rental agreement to deal with. Another thing that might happen to James. He's like, not so popular.
It's just a flop.
It's just a flop. There's like, nobody actually really cares what the insides of their houses look like here in Buffalo. And nobody hires him. And he now can't pay his rent. Right? See, these are very kind of common things. Or he might just learn that this was not the right neighborhood or wasn't the right type of facility for him as he's developing his business. Particularly with new businesses, this happens that they're kind of not quite right. The gym I go to, it was a new business for this guy, and he opened it up, and he quickly learned that it was too small, but he has a 5-year lease, and he's stuck now trying to figure out how he can get out of this 5-year lease, because he kind of just misjudged the space he needed, right? Very common thing to happen. All right, so James wants to move out. Anyone want to move into his place? Anybody else got a business idea? No one else has ever wanted to open any type of business? Will, yes?
Oh, I want to open a bar.
You want to open a bar? Okay. Jamie, will you let Will sublease James' place?
have no problem with him opening a bar?
I like bars and I like Will.
Okay, there you go. Oh, what's the name of the bar?
Clickies.
Business model is the type of risk I want to take. What type of questions would you ask it, Will, to see if he would be an okay representative?
I would want his credit information.
You want his credit information? Anything else?
Probably other things.
Maybe not. Maybe you're very trusting. Landlord, other things that you guys might be interested in knowing? Yeah?
Criminal history?
Oh, all right. Anything else? Yeah, great.
Bank statements or
things
collateral.
Yeah, so definitely like his financial stability. We might also want a little bit more understanding if he has any experience in actually running a business or owning a bar, or if he just has a cool name for it. Right? Like, so these are all types of things that the landlord is going to want to ask before they let the new person step in. Also, I was impressed how quickly you were willing to change from a pretty quiet interior decorating firm, right, to what could be a much different type of business. Not all people are going to let that. Now, what about you, James? Are you willing to sublet to Will?
No.
Why not?
Especially if I... tenancy agreements with Jamie about like the condition of his face and things like that. I would be nervous that Quickies would not abide by the rules that I've held to.
That there might be damage to the place?
Right. You know what I mean? The bar is not an interior design firm, so I'm sure the agreement that I signed for the condition of the space is not what would be held to for a bar.
Right, so now notice, depending on the type of agreement that's being entered into, both James and Jamie have a reason to really kind of be circumspect of Will and his business and whether or not they're willing to accept it. So here we have actually a situation where the landlord doesn't mind. So what would be a good type of agreement to enter into here under those circumstances? An assignment. Right? Because James wants no part of this deal. He would like to be able to get out of it. Sometimes we see an idea in contracts that we can import here to property law as well called novation, where you actually like we cross out James's name and enter into kind of and replace him on the lease agreement with Will's name. Right? Now, if it's a sublease, what's the difference? Yeah.
James still has a legal obligation to Jamie, and then Will would have an obligation to James, but there's no obligation between the landlord and the subletter.
Yeah.
Between Jamie.
We definitely get kind of these weird relationships
I think I might have flaws, but I can't remember. Right, where we have the landlord who we start with, and we have the original renter or tenant. And then we have this third person, right? And depending on the relationship here, whether we call this person a sublessee or an assignment, it'll shift the relationships that these people have to each other. These people are always in, as the parties who have signed the lease document are in a contractual relationship with each other, and we call that relationship privity of contract. Right, they are in privity of contract. Privity just being a fancy word to say that they are in a relationship with each other based on contract. And we use contract law to enforce that relationship and that obligation they have to each other. What's different about property is that we also will impose upon people a relationship, a legal relationship and legal obligations just based on their status of their relationship to the property itself, even if there's not a document that spells it out. So they have actually two types of relationships here. They have a privity of contract, and then we would also say that they have a privity of estate or a privity of property. That there's kind of they have two different obligations.
And we can think of that based actually upon all the kind of relationships and ideas that we already saw in landlord-tenant law. Right? We know that there's some obligations that come up because of the contract, what's in the lease itself, but there's some obligations that we know are there even without the terms of the lease. Right? The warranty of habitability, the doctrine of the covenant of quiet enjoyment. Those are things that exist even without you needing to put them in the lease. So we know that there's kind of certain obligations and ideas that kind of are beyond the written contract. Now, this third person, we can determine what types of relationship we want to exist based on how we structure it. So we'll look at examples, but we can think of kind of putting them in a contract relationship with each other. Or we could think of instead putting these two in a contract relationship with each other. It will change kind of how who owes obligations to whom. All right. An assignment. Assignment, we say that tenant one, match up my drawing to the thing. We say that tenant two steps into tenant one's shoes. They take on the obligations and the responsibilities. Usually, when that happens, tenant two takes on paying the rent and pays the rent directly to the landlord. Right? It kind of makes sense. They're stepping in their shoes, they're going to pay the rent. Every now and then you can find some other example where there's some weird payment that goes to a third party or goes like through where they actually pay the tenant who pays them or something. But the most common approach is that the tenant too pays the landlord directly. A sublet looks a little different. And it's more like these two people have a side deal. Anybody ever sublet an apartment? Either on either side of it? Arthur, you did? Were you the subletter or the sublessee?
The subletter.
The subletter. So it was your place and you had somebody else in it. Did you, what did that agreement look like that you made with that person?
Well, it was pretty basic, but we had like a house that we rent, that we had to lease out, and we like subletted part of because we had an extra room.
Mm-hmm.
So we like subletted extra to a third person.
So the third person did not join you on the lease with your landlord. Mm-hmm. It was just an agreement that they had with you.
Yeah.
How did you determine how much rent to pay them?
How
do you charge them?
Kind of know what the like market rate was there, and mm-hmm. we wanted to, like, because we had a really good deal on the house, so we knew we could just charge them more to cover our share of the rent.
Yeah, right? It does not have to be based on the deal you have with your landlord. You can create totally different rules, your own rules in that sublet agreement. Did you put any restrictions on them that weren't on you as a...
Not really, no. It was like a really basic agreement that we had.
Yeah, so I subletted my place once when I was in law school, because I was like one of these summer switches, right? Like I did a summer in a different city and somebody was coming to San Francisco for the summer, sublet my place. And I'm really allergic to like everything. And so I had made this really strict rule in my sublet agreement that said that the person couldn't have any animals in my apartment at any time, in my house at any time. But that was an agreement from my landlord, right? My landlord actually didn't care. I cared. So I was able to, in my sublet agreement, put on different constraints. I charged him the same rent that I pay, but you could do different ones, right? It's a side deal where you two create the terms that, at a minimum, you're going to want to put in there the terms that you're obliged to, as that the landlord said, right? This is kind of what James is getting at. He knows that he's going to have all these obligations in his lease. As a minimum, if he sublets that, he wants to make sure that the person is not damaging the premises, as maintaining whatever James has agreed to maintain, or like interior, exterior, stuff like that. But you can add on additional things. In New York City, right, if you have a rent-controlled apartment, many people do not actually live in those rent control apartments, right? They sublet them out for much more money than they actually pay in rent. I know most of my friends who live in New York City live in a rent control apartment that they are subletting from somebody who long ago moved away from New York City, and they pay them more than what that person pays in rent. All right, so this contract here. So now you're in privity of contract, T1 and T2, have a contractual agreement, and they have obligations and different side deals that they can... For the most part, usually, not always, but usually the tenant two pays rent to the tenant one, and tenant one pays rent to the landlord. Particularly if these are going to be different rent amounts. So actually that same summer, I subletted a place in Madison, Wisconsin, where I was doing my 1L summer. And I have to tell you, the apartments were easy to come by, right? There was not a lot of demand for people who were spending the summer in Madison, Wisconsin, in the same way there was for people spending the summer in San Francisco. So I actually paid the person I subletted for much less than she paid her landlord. So you can see why it makes sense that these people are making payments to each other as opposed to landlord. But it doesn't have to be the defining factor. Sometimes we do see sublets where tenant two agrees just, if it's going to be the same amount of rent, agrees just to pay that rent to the landlord. And it does not disrupt their definition of it being a sublet. It's just kind of these are the standard things. We'll get into a little bit more details about how we can tell the difference between these two. So know that this idea of who you pay rent to is what is the usual pattern, but we can't really look at who the rent is paid to for a good understanding of whether we should define it as an assignment or sublease. Tabitha.
This is probably a really dumb question, but can some landlords put in their contracts that they don't want any subletting at all?
Did you do the reading for today?
I did.
Did you see that there's a case all about whether or not you can put that in your agreement?
No, but I did.
We will get to it.
I did the reading that was for So.
I know I'm confusing you by putting these a little out of order. We will get to this, and you will see that that question is not only not a stupid one, it's a pretty important one, and not always a clear answer. All right, but let's start, before we get to that case, let's do the Ernst v. Condit type case first. Nate Fleming, can you help us with this one? Let's see, now I got to take out my cards. Make a plan, it falls apart on you. Tylena? All right, let's start with these cases, these two cases here are complicated in figuring out what all the different deals are. So, but let's just start. Who owns this property? Okay. And who is renting the property?
He leases it to a guy named Rogers.
Oh, I thought I deleted this slide. Okay, wait. Here's the first half of the case timeline. For some reason, this is split in two. Okay, right? So first, the Ernst, they lease it to Rogers for 1 year and 7 days. Why do you think it was leased for 1 year and 7 days? Yeah, just to end on an even number, I think. All right. So, and Rogers, what is Rogers leasing this property for? Go-kart racetrack. This is not the exact one, but it is this level. It's not really as fancy as this one. It's more of a kind of a dirt racetrack here, leased on this property. Now, what does Rogers do with his go-kart business here? Yeah, very quickly, actually. I'm not sure if he changed his mind immediately or why, or if something happened to his health or something, but he very quickly kind of changes his mind about running this business and sells it. All right. What do the landowners think about this transfer of the business from Rogers to Condit?
Well, there was a provision in the lease that prohibited subletting and assignment. There was also
right, so there are a couple things. One is that there's not only a provision to pay rent in this lease, in the original lease, but there's also this language about any kind of changes they have made to the property have to be returned to the original condition. So these are some of the covenants in the lease that the tenant is responsible for. All right, what happens when Condit moves in?
He stops paying rent. Argue that Rogers
remained
responsible for the rent because there was an assignment
at least. Close. He's arguing. Come on, slides. right. He's arguing the opposite, though. Okay, all right. So here's what happens, though. 1960, right, very... So July, look at this. June 18th, he enters into this lease. July, right? Less than a month later, he's already realizing he wants to sell his business, and he starts to negotiate with Condit for the sale of it. We don't really have the background information that explains why this happens. Condit wants a two-year lease. He wants a little bit more protection than just this one lease in 7 days. He wants a kind of a little bit of knowledge that his business is going to be able to be there for a while, right? To build a racetrack and to kind of remove it could be a lot of work. Condit and Rogers go to the Ernsts and negotiate with them to kind of make some changes to the lease. And in that also, Roger transfers his interest to Condit. And it's not clear what we should call that transfer. From August to November, Condit operates the track. He pays the rents for them for August, September, and October, and then he stops paying rent. Ernst contact Rogers in December and complain about the fact that other guy hasn't paid rent. And he says he doesn't owe them. Sorry, this is the wrong name on there. It should be Condit. All right, but let me move to the lease language. All right, here's the original lease that Tanya's mentioned. The lessee shall have no right to assign or sublet the lease premises without prior written approval of the lessors. In the event of any assignment or sublease, lessee is still liable to perform the covenants of this lease, including the covenant to pay rent. Nothing here shall be construed as releasing the lessee from his liabilities and obligations. All right, this is the original lease. Right, so you can see why this requirement of prior written consent means that when Rogers wants to sublet or assign, what it says assign or sublet, whatever, we're not quite sure what he's doing, but whatever this relationship is, when he's transferring to Condit, he's got to go to his landlords first and make sure it's okay, and then he gets it in writing. All right, so then does he get it in writing that it's okay?
No.
50-50 chance
yeah.
Here?
I'm going to say no.
Oh, you bet wrong. Okay, he renegotiates the lease. And the new lease says, the lessor hereby consents to the subletting of the premises to AK Condit. He gets it in writing that it's okay. Right? So he's following the obligations of his original lease by getting it in writing. With the understanding, however, that Rogers is going to remain personally liable for the faithful performance of all terms and conditions of the original lease and of this amendment to the original lease. Just reading those two documents together, do you think that this looks like a sublease or an assignment? Kylie, what would you call this?
I would say it's an assignment.
Say it again?
I would say it's an assignment.
It's an assignment. Why would you say that?
That's what the court said.
No, okay, well, that's what the court said. Looking at these two documents, what in here, based on either the court's reasoning or your own, makes you think this looks like an assignment?
That, like, he has it, there's no, possibility that the lessor is
going to
come back.
The lessor?
Yeah.
Which one's the lessor? You talking about the first tenant, Rogers, or the second one? Condit.
Oh, yeah. God, this is confusing.
Yeah. That's why we're breaking it down, right?
So Rogers, I guess. Rogers.
Yeah. So we know that this is how it starts, right? That Ernst and Rogers are in this agreement. And they're in privity of contract, and they're in privity of estate. They're both ways. They're in this relationship with each other. They have duties and obligations to each other. Once we add into this Condit, we have to try to figure out what we think Condit's relationship is here. Now, as the court explains, the court says, we think this looks like an assignment. Anyone argue for this being a sublease? Right? Why?
You use the word sublet.
I think actually if you read this, you assume it's a sublet because of the word sublet. And the court says we don't actually care whether they use the word sublet or assignment. Perhaps because we know that people are really bad at choosing which of those words they really mean. And instead we should think about the intent of the parties. And I'll tell you, you started to tell us this. How do we figure out the intent, whether the parties intended a sublease or an assignment?
Well, if Rogers was going to come back and take over.
Yes. The court says when it's we know a sublease because in a sublease, the original tenant, tenant one, Rogers in this case, is going to come back again.
So if you think about kind of your own experiences with subletting places, you don't think of yourself as handing over your whole apartment to them. You think of the apartment as coming back to you afterwards. And the court says that's what a sublease is. It's where tenant one, Rogers, retains some type of reversionary interest. Some type of interest where we think it's going to revert back to Rogers. Even if that's just for one day, even if it's just for 1 hour, we say that that's a reversionary interest that makes it a sublease. Anytime you actually intend to get Rogers out of the picture to convey the whole thing to Condit, the whole thing to tenant two, that's an assignment. Now, the important thing here is, why did Condit want to call this a sublease?
What difference would that make? Is he not responsible for rent then? For instance.
He'd be responsible to Rogers.
He would say, okay, I acknowledge I've got this contract with this guy. And I even acknowledge that I'm actually in some kind of privity of estate with this guy because I have this, he's got a reversionary interest and stuff like that. But I'm not in any relationship actually with them, not in a contractual relationship. Maybe I owe Rogers rent, and if Rogers wants to sue me, go ahead. But landlords, Ernst, you can't come after me. You've got to go after Rogers. Why do you think they haven't gone after Rogers? Mary?
Maybe Rogers doesn't have any money
because
his business failed.
Yeah, right? Maybe he doesn't have any money. Maybe we don't even know where he is. You know, I don't know, maybe he had really bad health problems. Maybe that's why, we don't know. But there's all these different reasons why that they don't seem to be going after Rogers. Would Rogers still be responsible to them if this was a sublease? Absolutely. Is he still responsible to them if it's an assignment? Everyone says no? What about the language of this agreement right here in front of you? Even if we were to change this line about them being in this property relationship with each other, he has actually at least explicitly in contractual terms agreed to pay the rent. Ernst should still be able to, can still go after Rogers because of that. The question the court is trying to ask is whether or not they can go after both Rogers and Condit. Jamie?
Did you say that Condit may want to be a sublease because then he's only liable to Rogers and not, but what's the difference in that? Because either way, he's still going to get sued by someone. So what's the difference?
Rogers isn't around to sue him.
So that's just like in this case, it's not like generally a reason why?
Yes, right. Being a subletter or assignment does not change the fact that you still have obligations. It just changes who your obligations are to. Right, so his argument is the landlords cannot sue him because he is a subletter. The landlords can only sue the person that they're actually in kind of privity of contract with. Now notice here, the sublease itself was not signed by the Ernst. That agreement, that contract between the two of them, a sublease or is it an assignment, is signed by T1 and T2, Rogers and Condit. All of these actually is making, I think, pretty good evidence for calling it a sublease, right? The two of them are in a contract with each other. We use the word sublease in there. And yet, the court sticks very strongly to the common law approach to subleases and assignments, which say it has to be something that contains a reversion for T1 for it to be considered a sublease. And the lack of reversion here, the lack of anything saying that it'll go back to Rogers in any way, suggests that all of the parties concerned meant for all of Rogers' interests to transfer to Condit. All right. These diagrams may help more than my scribblings. Here is the relationship that arises if you have an assignment. The lessor and the lessee. So Ernst and Rogers in this part would still remain in privity of contract. They still had an agreement that they signed together. We still see that language about Rogers being liable for the rent. You would also have Rogers and Condit in privity of contract based on the sublease, the assignment agreement, right? They had a deal with each other. But the privity of a state in assignment shows us that there becomes a relationship between the lessor and the signee, between the Ernst and Condit. Even though the two of them never signed the same agreement, right? There's no agreement out there that Condit and Ernst have both signed. They signed separate agreements. But they say, you still have a relationship to me based on our relationship regarding the property. By stepping into the tenant's shoes, you take on all of the obligations and ideas that we think of the tenant as having, including the covenant to pay rent. Does that make sense? No, Charlotte.
Oh, I just want to be sure that the only point where the court found that no, this is an assignment and not a sublease is because there was no language indicating possible reentry.
Exactly. Well, it's not just possible reentry. It's more than that. It's the idea of, because there's some cases, though, there's some courts that will say vague language about a potential reentry still don't shift the balance. But that kind of trying to argue he had a right to come back and reenter, an implied right of reentry that the courts did not find persuasive. The real issue is that we say that there's, this is the way to think of it. You have a relationship with the person. You, as a sublessor or signee or whatever, you're going to have a relationship with the person who's going to get the property when you move out, the person who has the next possessory interest. When that person is actually tenant one, because the property reverts back to tenant one, we call it a sublease. When that next person in line is actually the landlord, the landowner, we call it an assignment. Does that help? So that's why this is the diagram then for the sublease. Right, now you don't have any kind of relationship. You don't have any privity of estate between the sublessee, between T2 and the landlord. Because the relationship, the privity of estate is established by who's going to come and take the property after T2 moves out. And in this case, it goes back to T1, it goes back to the sublessee. Yeah.
I'm just not 100% clear on why an assignment is not like a new lease with the T2.
So they actually, if it had done it that way, that would be it would have been a very nice and clear thing, and we would have thought of that as a. Do you remember last week when we talked about this? If somebody actually just leaves willingly, what do we call that? You just let your tenant leave. Surrender, right? You would just be accepting their surrender. So if we actually had instead of these agreements, instead of kind of the, what we have here is we have a renegotiated lease between landlord and T1, and we have a sublet agreement, or an assignment agreement, or whatever we want to call that agreement. We have an agreement between T1 and T2. A much cleaner way of doing this would have been if they just allowed Rogers to surrender and entered into a new lease with Condit, and then we would just be thinking about that new lease and what it's doing there. Why didn't they do that? Why not do that? That seems a lot cleaner. If you're the landlord, why might you not want to do that? Yeah, Tim.
First time you can't stop, then you can't stop.
You want to keep Rogers on the hook for the money. That's why they're not doing it. Maybe that wasn't a good idea because the guy ends up kind of being nowhere, not having the money, or for some reason. So maybe it wasn't a good decision about them. Maybe it would have been a better decision for them to enter into this other agreement. But the reason they did it in this weird format instead of allowing a surrender and a new lease is because they wanted to keep T1 in privity of contract with them so that he still had some obligations to pay the rent if Condit ended up being a bad tenant. Yeah? This is the relationship they did not have, right? This is the one they did have. If they had, instead of doing an assignment, just renegotiated a new lease that
then the only relationships here we would have had, we would have crossed out any of the arrows that went to lessee assignor, and we would have just had a normal landlord-tenant relationship along that blue line. And we would have both privity of estate and privity of contract. They did not do that because by doing an assignment instead, they remain in privity of contract with the lessee and could still go after the lessee for kind of a breach of contract if the rent is not paid and things like that. In this case, that wasn't helpful for them because the lessee became, we don't know, the lessee wasn't a good person to go after. They weren't a viable defendant just for whatever reason. But they didn't know that at the time they did the assignment.
Doesn't it say, or maybe I misread it, that if it's an assignment, the original T1 isn't responsible for complaints?
T1 is still responsible. But T1 is responsible under the basis of the contract.
Okay.
Right? So if we think of the lease, or the renegotiated lease, if we think of those things, this is a weird thing about landlord-tenant, where we have to think about both contract law and property law, and it gets confusing to have like an agreement based on these two different things. If you think of it just based on contract law, they still have an agreement that they have to fulfill all of the terms of the contract. Anything that's property law-based, any of those kind of conditions that we think of as being just based on kind of privity of estate, just based on kind of what we think of as common law property, are not there. It's only what the terms are of that agreement. And so they're obliged under that contract that said they were going to pay out.
So one last question. You could sue either T1 or T2.
The lessor could sell, yes, the landlord could sell T1, sue T1 or T2. That's why they want to do this, right? That's because two people that they might be able to sue. If my rent is not paid, if the place is damaged, anything. They can sue one under privity of contract, they can sue one under privity of estate. That's why this is preferable often for a landlord. Other times a landlord would rather just like, they know who T1 is, they know how to get their money, they've got their deposit from them, and they just don't really want to deal with T2. And they're totally fine with the sublease. Right? I'm just going to go after you. I know who you are, Rogers. I know where I have your credit information. I find you to be reliable. I know you have enough money that I can sue you if damage happens, or I'm sitting on your deposit and that's going to cover everything. I don't want to have to deal with another contract or get my attorneys involved or blah, blah, blah. So go ahead and sublease. You deal with that. So you can see why landlords or tenants might choose any of these. Right. Make sense? We feel like we know the difference? Martha.
So I was in a 2-year lease once that we wanted to get out early. So she let us sublease to someone for like the last 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
But they could do a rent that was like $50 lower a month. So we paid the difference up front to the landlord. The new person coming in paid her whatever. But we weren't coming back.
Okay, you've lost me already. You want to diagram it?
I guess I'm just saying, even if you're making terms on the side with someone, if you're not coming back, that's still an assignment.
Yeah, right. So this is the point of this court, right? They're like, we're not going to look at kind of what terms they use. We're going to look at just, they're following the common law approach that says all we're going to do is look at whether or not there's reversionary interest. And we don't care kind of what your agreements actually say or what phrases you call it. So they would have, if that apartment was never going back to you, that was really an assignment, even if you guys called it a sublease.
But we were still on the hook.
You're still on the hook, even if it's an assignment, right? Remember this diagram.
Okay.
Yeah? Okay. We've been talking about the common law rule. In the common law rule, you have to retain a right of reentry for it to be a sublet, even if that's just one day, arguably even if it's just an hour. You have to make T1 have some type of reversionary interest. The more modern rule, which is discussed in the notes, is that we look at the intent of the parties and see whether or not it looks like the transfer is trying to retain a reversion. The modern rule is a messier rule. It just depends on what we think our public policy should be. One is like the common law rule is a very kind of clear rule. We just look at the agreement and say, is there any type of reversion back to T1? If not, it's an assignment.
But the modern rule gets more at trying to fulfill the desires of the people actually in the agreement. It gets more at this idea, maybe we should look at whether or not they intended it to be like a sublease or an assignment.
What were their thoughts about who's going to have to pay rent to who?
And the jurisdictions are just split here between the common law rule and the modern rule.
How would you be able to tell whether or not like they intend to have a right of reentry? Because like what Martha was saying, it's like she might never actually physically come back to that apartment. It just seems kind of like a concept rather than like...
Okay, yeah, so this is always a tricky thing. I hopefully you remember this from some of our earlier cases. When we're looking at leases, for the most part, and this came up also with looking at wills, looking at conveyances, anytime we're looking at these documents regarding property, we look at the what's in the documents themselves, the four corners of the property, or the four corners of the document. Remember that phrase, the four corners of the document? So to try and divine intent, we would actually look at kind of what these lease agreements said. What did it actually say in this agreement that that was in Martha's original lease? Maybe we'd actually look at whether or not she wrote a sublease agreement and what that said, or maybe if there was any renegotiated language, we'd look at that. Now, one of the benefits we have here, in contrast to when we're looking at some of our documents that are wills, is that we actually have living people that we can also go and ask. So we always start with the strongest evidence is always within the four corners of the document. But most courts will also allow us to look at extrinsic evidence. Extrinsic just meaning outside of those documents. And so maybe we would look at emails exchanged between the two of them. We might actually, some courts might be willing even to look at kind of have them come to the stand and explain what their views are, but there's a feeling that they would, I don't want to say be dishonest, but not that the best actual evidence of a landlord-tenant would be something that we have in writing, some types of agreements like that.
So that's how we would try and look at that intent. But you can see it's much easier if we follow the common law rule. It's a little bit more straightforward. So you see courts kind of shifting back and forth on this. This is not something that we see written out by statute. So it's more of a common law kind of idea. And even courts that have adopted the modern approach have kind of sometimes shifted back because it's messier. So we're just about half and half, and it kind of switches back and forth sometimes which rule. So you just have to double check your jurisdiction to see which of these approaches that they're following. Yeah, okay. Kendall versus Pestana. Tabitha, did you read this case?
I did, but I was talking like last week. I said, give it a go. You can do it.
Give it a go. You can do it.
But I have to stand very dry. I would be better than the next day. Okay, all right.
Not how the world happens, Teresa, someday. All right, who owns the property in question here?
Okay, so the property is owned by Kendall.
No.
Okay, so the property is owned by the city of San Jose.
There you go. The city of San Jose owns this property. What is this property used for?
It's used for an airport.
And specifically, that's what the larger piece of property is used for. What specifically are these people using it for?
They are using it for, well, it's a commercial lease. You know, you give me a hard time with this one. All right. Okay, so they were the owner of this property. They leased it to Ernie Perlich, who in turn assigned their lease to respondent Ernest Pestana. And I'm not answering your question.
You're not answering my question, no.
Okay.
Does anybody know what is going on? What is actually like physically happening on the ground here? Francis.
It's a hangar and like repair
services. So, I'm sorry, you're a little quiet.
It's a hangar and repair services.
Yeah, this is like an airplane. So it's an airplane hangar. Drawing of one there, and they're using it as like an airplane maintenance facility, right? Now, the reason San Jose, anyone knows what goes on in that part of the country? Silicon Valley. So a surprisingly large number of people that have their own private jets that need airplane maintenance and repair, right? So it's not exactly like Delta Airlines, like where they have their own crew, right? This is like, and over time, right, in the 80s, this is actually at the height of this, where Silicon Valley is really kind of taking off, and they have a lot of need for this business. This business is really growing from the beginning. All right. Tabitha, this is, I know this is rough. This is why we have a drawing for you, because this is a very complicated one. Yeah, yeah.
They, I read 2 weeks ago, and...
Do you guys do drawings as you read these things? Sometimes? Do you guys just, like, not do it because you know I'm going to show you one? I have to do the drawings to understand these cases. The easement cases, God, I have no idea unless I do the drawing for those. And this one, too. I had to really sit there and diagram these relationships. I found it very confusing. All right. And this is confusing and yet not unusual of what we see in big commercial leases. The city of San Jose owns the airport, owns all these hangars on it. The city of San Jose does not really want to be involved in day-to-day operations about what goes on in all those different airline hangars, right? So they lease the premises to the Perlichers. And the Perlichers are like, look, they're overseeing all the different hangars that people are renting out, right? They can think of it as that they're kind of become the managers of the airport. They are not actually running any of these businesses themselves. The business they run is kind of managing the airport and leasing out the different hangars and the different businesses and stuff like that. So of the larger property, the Perlichers lease out one hangar to Bixler, right? Bixler is the one who builds up this business. He builds up this airplane maintenance business. He's running it for years. He's doing a great job. He decides to retire, and he wants to sublease his business to Kendall, O'Hara, and Hara, like these three people who come forward and want to take over the business. Yeah, we understand that part of the diagram. The other part of the diagram is that also over the course of this kind of many years, the Perlichers are also kind of ready to get out of this business. And so they are subleasing their overarching business, which is managing the airport, to Pestana. Does that make sense? Right, so now we have actually these, neither one of these, we don't have, the landlords is not involved actually here. And we're not even talking about obligations to the city of San Jose. We're talking about the ability of kind of the person running the place, the now Pestana, the new people who took over, and whether or not in Kendall, right? So you see how this is actually two people who we don't have any arrow between, right? That we don't have any connection between them. All right, now Tabitha, now that we've got kind of the diagram figured out, why are the Kendalls bringing suit against Pestana? What are they upset about?
Well, what happened was Mr. Bixter, he requested permission to assign interest to the Kendalls, and they were refused by the defendant, which is Esther and Pestana Incorporated.
So what is the common law default rule if your lease is silent? If it doesn't say anything about assignments or subleases, what is the default rule? Are you allowed to transfer your interest?
Well, the common law's hostility towards restraint and alienation, they don't like to have sort of like restraints on leaseholds.
So what would that mean?
Well, they don't like it to be like strictly construed. They would like to be able to have like the subletting.
Exactly, right. So absent anything in the document itself, so if you guys go home and you read your lease, if there's nothing in that lease that mentions assignment or subletting, you have the right to assign and sublet. Because our default presumption in property law is always free alienation, free transferability. We like to have a free flow of land and property interest because we believe that is the most efficient thing for society. All right. So, absent something in the agreement, this sublease, there would have been no problem, and they wouldn't even have had to go and ask Perlichers or Pestana. They wouldn't have had. But the fact that they had to go ask Pestana tells us that there was something in that sublease in their lease. What did it say?
Let me find it. they said that the respondent demanded increased rent and other more.
Okay, that is what he asked. That's part of their negotiations. But I'm trying to get at the language of the sublease itself. Can you find it in there? I think Tyler was trying to point it out to you.
She's trying to point it out to me, but I can't make out what she's saying.
All right, I think Beth has it. What is it, Beth?
The sublease provided that written consent of the sublessor was required before the sublessee could assign his interest, and that failure to obtain such consent rendered the sublease voidable at the option of the sublessor.
Okay, so that actually looks very similar to the language you saw in the last case, and this actually, if you did pull up your lease, this is the most common thing for them to say. Yes, you are allowed to assign or sublet. You can only do so, however, if the landlord, or in this case, it's the sublandlord, gives you permission to do so. So in this case, Costanza is saying, yes, you may sublease to Kendall and O'Hara, but you can only do so with my permission. And now we have to get at the idea of what are the reasons for Pistana withholding their permission. Can they do so for any reason whatsoever? When we talked about it in terms of Jamie allowing the sublease, right? She could have legitimate reasons that she wouldn't have sublet it. She could have decided she didn't want that change in business. Maybe she actually, you know, got the bank records and found that Will was not reliable. You know, all of those would have been legitimate reasons. Here we actually have suggestions that Kendall and O'Hara and her, that they're actually very stable, you know, financial backing and stuff like that. So we don't have actually that type of reason. Maybe, is there another reason? Why is it, Tabitha, that Pistana is withholding his consent for the sublease?
He's just not a nice guy.
He's not a nice guy? You think that's all it is?
That's probably part of it.
You started to tell us about it. What is it that he wants?
Well, he wants alienation. And he wants restraint from...
He's a businessman. What do you think he wants?
Well, he wants more money.
He wants more money. Right? So think about this. I don't think it mentions the lease term there. Does it say it?
No.
But it's probably a long-term lease. It's a commercial lease. This has been going on for a couple of years. So we're probably looking at something that's like a 10-year lease.
Oh, okay. No, it's a 25-year lease.
25-year lease. 25 years ago, Silicon Valley wasn't booming. Not everybody had a private jet. Now all of a sudden they all have private jets. There's a lot of business here. There's a lot of money that can be made in renting out hangar space. More than whatever the rent is that Bixler had been paying. So Pistana sees this opportunity of a sublease as being a place where he can change the rental terms. Where he could get an increase in rent for that. So this is why he says no. Does that make sense? He's like, look, you cannot sublease without my permission, and my permission is contingent upon them paying more rent. And was there something else, too? Or is it just the paying more rent? Yeah.
I believe it was just paying more rent.
All right, this is what happens. I don't have my notes. All right, so okay. All right, so but this is now the question is, can he do that? Kendall takes him to court over this. Can he withhold his permission when you have a lease that says you can withhold permission?
No.
Why not?
They said that they require that a consent provision in a lease be read as requiring reasonable objection to the assignment to withhold consent. They said what I said, that the law generally favors free alienability of property, but contractual restrictions on alienability of leasehold interests are permitted. They said that California would adhere to the minority rule, that when a lease provides for assignment, only the prior consent of the leaser or such consent may be withheld, only where the leaser has a commercially reasonable objection to the assignment.
Okay, exactly. Commercially reasonable objection. So the court here says, look, you put a provision in the lease that said you were going to, that the person had to come to you and get permission. We would assume that means that you're going to give permission unless there's a commercially reasonable justification for denying that.
Right. What is in
meeting one link to property value and commercially reasonable?
It seems like a commercially reasonable one, but they say no. So there's a couple things built, there's a couple kind of complicated things wrapped up in here. The first is that if you have such a provision in your lease that says the landlord has the ability, has to approve all subleases, has to approve all subtenants or assignments, can they withhold that for any reason? Many courts said yes. Right? That's why this is the minority rule. Many courts say yeah. And you probably got a cheaper rent or perhaps got a better deal by giving that landlord total permission, total control over who your subtenant is. Other courts, the minority rule, said no, it seems unreasonable. If you had a provision in there, it seems like it's there to facilitate subleasing. And if you're just going to withhold permission based on any kind of change you want to make to the agreement, that's not fair. So the idea here, Greg, is that that 25-year lease, both sides took a chance in entering a 25-year lease, right? The landlord takes a chance that the value of the property is going to go up, and they got less rent than they hoped, and they could have charged more rent. And but the tenant takes a risk, too, that they're going to end up paying more rent than they really should have. So if both people entering into a 25-year lease are taking a gamble on what they think are going to happen to property values. And I said, the court says, it's not really fair to allow the landlord to renegotiate that gamble that it took by at year 20 coming in and asking for more rent. They should be bound by that 25-year term. Also, there's some background idea here. I think that Bixler probably was the one who kind of actually built up this business and made it so valuable, and it's not fair for the landlord to kind of make money off of kind of Bixler's efforts. I think that this is a minority rule also because both parties here, and it's true in most commercial leases, are represented by attorneys. An attorney should have argued for something more specific. Right? That Bixler's attorney should have made sure the language in there said, and such, you know, approval should not be reasonably withheld. That by putting in those, you know, four more words, that Bixler would have gotten something more, and that if he was represented by attorneys, they should have been smart enough to do that. Other people would argue, well, then, maybe Perlich's attorney should have been smart enough to make sure that the language said and it could be withheld for any reason. So you have a little bit of kind of battle here of what we think the default rule should be in California, because, as Tabitha mentions, they're using the background justification of making property as alienable as possible. So if we have ever had any vague terms within a lease, we are going to err both on the side of making it more alienable, making it easier to transfer interest, and usually we err on the side of the tenant as the feeling that that's probably the party that had the less power in there. Tylena, do you have your hand up? Never mind. Okay. Awesome. All right, so we have, let's see if I have another slide or no. Nope. Okay, so we have then this idea that generally we're going to have, we learn in this case not just something about subleases, but we learn something about interpreting landlord-tenant agreements, so interpreting these leases. If they're vague, we're going to err on the side that kind of fulfills the public policy ideas of fewer restraints on the property. And we're also going to err on the side of usually interpreting it against the landlord. Now, this is a commercial lease. Should we have the same rule for a residential lease? Commercially reasonable? What is it commercially? What's the phrase, Tim? Is it that you read to us that you can only withhold it for like commercially reasonable reasons? That seems circular.
Yeah, reasonable objection.
Okay. All right. Should that be the same idea for a residential lease, that it should really only be based on like maybe the economic status of the sublessor, Charlie?
I don't believe so, because I believe residential lease is different. Essential elements to it that commercial lease does.
So what do you think?
A good example, a residential lease usually has your home, that's your house. You should be entitled to have certain protections over it, especially if the leaseor needs to have the house in certain conditions that the VC can provide.
So generally we think of the commercial tenant not having to deal as much with the landlord. And it is, under this case, not acceptable to deny a sublease lessor because they're a jerk. However, In a residential situation, that is a totally acceptable reason to deny a subletting. Right? We actually have a different default rule in most jurisdictions if it's residential, which does allow the land. Look, when you have the provisions in there that say that the landlord has to approve the subletter or the assignee in a residential lease instead of a commercial lease, they have a much broader latitude in denying that subletter. It's not just kind of these financial commercial ideas, but actually kind of almost any justifiable reason. In some jurisdictions, any reason at all. Unless you hit, and if you don't want that, you better specifically negotiate in your lease that says kind of won't be reasonably withheld or something like that.
So are we consenting with knowledge of like who the like lessor would be?
Say it again.
So like when the lessor consents to like a sublease, do they know who the person is that they want to sublease to?
Yes, right, so that's the whole point, right? So it says in your agreement, right, we see that language in both these agreements that said you have to come for, you can't assign or sublet without written approval. So you don't just say generally I want to sublet it. You come forward with the person. That's why we saw the language of the last one that says AK Condit would be an acceptable sublet. You have written approval for it.
So then how does the majority rule that you can, like, allow consent or, like, deny that for any reason, like, how does that relate to discrimination cases? So
we still have the Fair Housing Act would still come into play. So it is true that that other law limits us. So the common law of property does not limit us in the ability of saying that the landlord can refuse that sublease for any reason. The Fair Housing Act is a layer on top of that, would prevent the landlord from using one of the seven protected classes as a reason for saying no, and we would enter into that burden shifting framework to determine whether or not we really thought that's what they were getting at.
Right. So do they have to say, like, in the majority rule, do they have to say what the reason is? Since it's like brand new.
The landlord?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They usually still have to say the reason. I mean, especially if it went to if there was no protected class involved, maybe they wouldn't have to mention it. But I just don't see cases like that. Usually they say, like, I just don't want to deal with a new person, or I find that person noisy, or they have pets, or it's money, you know, so it's like, once you have the agreement in your lease that says you can sublease with written approval, that usually means that the person writes and says also why they're denying it. Does that make sense?
It just seems kind of messy. Like, I feel like they can just be like, 'cause I don't want to, and then it could be really because the person is gay.
Well, that's exactly the whole point of the Fair Housing Act, although it wouldn't protect somebody who's gay, right? Then we'd have to look at state laws. But if that's the whole point of having the burden-shifting framework, because we know that people are not going to fess up to their real motivations for a lot of times. And also true if it was retaliatory, as we saw in the last one, so we were like, well, that person we know kind of files a lot of complaints with the housing authority or something like that. After this case, California changed their statute. California didn't actually like what the court did, and they actually changed the law and wrote a statute now governing this. There had not been statutory law here. It had just been common law. They wrote a statute saying, if you say you're going to deny, you can consent for any reason, it's consent for any reason. And if you want it to be otherwise, if you want it to be this commercial viability or not reasonably withheld, attorneys, you're now on notice in California that you better actually explicitly write that into the lease agreement. All right. Any landlord-tenant questions remaining? All right, cool. Let's take a break, and then we'll do easements. All right, so now we're moving on to a category of the book called Private Land Use Planning. Kind of an interesting approach to it. Really, these are land use doctrines that develop before planning. Right? We'll talk about zoning and planning coming chapters. But here were some ideas of kind of using traditional property law mechanisms to shape what your community looks like. And so these were ways that individuals and even sometimes local governments could use property law to figure out where different uses should be. And these come in the terms of what I think of as servitudes, which fall into the category of easements and covenants, and then also the idea of nuisance, kind of being a traditional common law doctrine that we can use to kind of shape what our communities look like. Another way to think of this is that is to think of it as we've moved from the idea of talking about possessory interest in land, right? And we talk about this idea of present possessory interest in land. Who's actually occupying the land today and what are they doing? And then I kind of hinted to you guys when we talked about that, that we would be seeing something later in the course that I call, that we call non-possessory interest in land. What would that mean? What would it mean to have a non-possessory interest in land? It's not temporary, because you could have a temporary use that's possessory. It's something you have an interest in land that is not possessory. Higher.
Sounds like a right to use, but you don't actually own the land.
Yes. So it's a right to kind of use the land. It might be a right to enter the land or come on the land. You are not the one who possesses it. You are not the one who occupies it. You are not the one who has the kind of present rights to it. A lease might be temporary, but it's still a possessory right. You still have the ability to kind of move in and use the land. The non-possessory rights are rights that somebody other than the land occupier has in your land. Something, a right that somebody has to come and use your land for something, do something on your land, cross your land, things like that. Some of them feel pretty permanent, as we'll see, but they are not the people who actually kind of have the full daily control over what happens on the property. The largest category of this comes in as easements. All right, so modern law of servitudes. It really begins in the 19th century. Before that, we actually just kind of said a landowner had all the rights to their land, and there was no such thing as kind of this non-possessory right. But in the 19th century, they started to realize that there could be some interests and some things that fulfill public policy, things that are help kind of the utilitarian fulfillment of, like, the best way to use land if we allowed some people to have these non-possessory interests. And it particularly happens with the Industrial Revolution, the advents of roads and utilities and things like that, and kind of new forms of kind of land, almost transportation, really changed our land use arrangements. All right, so what do I have here? For something to be a non-possessory right, we really say it's any right that's something less than a day-to-day possession. Possession remains with the landowner, and we call that landowner the servient landowner, and the land that is owned by them, the servient estate. And you can think of that as that it is land that is in service to another in some way. Somebody else is using your land. And the servient landowner retains all the rights to make all the uses of the land that don't interfere with whatever that non-possessory right is. So they can do whatever they want as long as it's not interfering with an established non-possessory right. And we'll see examples of that. For the most part, these are agreements among landowners. And we'll see exceptions to that. But the basic idea of the easements and the covenants are that they are agreements among landowners, people making agreements with their neighbors about how land is going to be used. The most common easement is a right-of-way, a right to cross your neighbor's property. Does anybody have an easement on their land, either growing up or anything? Arthur, you have one?
Well, the town had one. We have a cottage up in the Thousand Islands. And, like, we own the property, but there was, like, a public boat launch, and they came down the road we owned to be able to use the public boat launch.
Right, so the easement there is not that they own that road, right? It's that they have the right to use that road. The road is still then owned by Arthur's family. Right, anyone else see these? Francis?
Multiple utility easements on the house as well as I have an easement to the property behind my house to get to the water.
By car or by foot?
By foot.
Yeah, so that these are also very common, right? So often if somebody lives near a natural resource, there might be footpaths or easements that they're allowed to and access the park, access a lake nearby. Utility easements, if you didn't dawn on you, almost all of us live in a place that has utility easements that are kind of other people who have the utility companies have rights. We'll get to those specifically in a little bit.
This isn't my own property, but I noticed in the Adirondacks when you go hiking in the peaks, a lot of times the trails to the mountains will actually go through private property, so I remember it being important to, like, actually stay on the trail in those points because you're actually going through someone's land.
Yeah, and those could have been done in a few different ways. They could be easements. They could actually be eminent domain where somebody purchased where government just purchased just the trail. It could be done through something called conservation easements. There's a lot of different agreements that could be made there. I have one. My my neighbor's driveway is actually, if we were to look at the deed, half of that is my land. So they have an easement to use the driveway. But I still have all access to that land for, I don't know what I do with my job. My kids draw pictures there. I don't know. Stuff like that. I can use it for what I can, but I can use that area that is my neighbor's driveway for anything I want to, as long as it doesn't interfere with her use of it as a driveway. So whatever I might come up with, which is mostly seems to be riding big wheels, but maybe that'll evolve. Amanda. It's actually not my, I don't use it as a driveway, only she uses it as a driveway. And so I don't have any need to upkeep her easement. I just have a need to not interfere with her easement. So she plows the driveway because you maintain your non-possessory rights. The landowner is not required to maintain them. You are required to maintain your non-possessory rights. So if that involves you needing to clear a trail or shovel a walk or anything like that, that would be there. So if Francis's neighbor, he has a pathway through his neighbor's yard, he can't really complain if that gets overgrown with weeds. That would be his job to maintain that, which he does, right? So your job, the utility company that has a pathway, has an easement that goes through like your trees in your backyard to your house, it is not your responsibility unless you have written that into the easement to maintain those trees. The default is that it would be the responsibility of the telephone company to come in and trim the trees around it. You could have an easement where somebody wrote otherwise in it, but the default is that the owner of the non-possessory right is the one who has the upkeep responsibility. All right. And so the people we call the two parties here are thought of as the dominant estate and the servient estate. And I find that people often get these terms confused because they think of the dominant estate as the property that we're talking about and we're concerned about. And that's usually not true. We're usually talking about and concerned about the servient estate, the piece of property that is serving the person's non-possessory right. So in Francis's example of the property that he crosses, the servient estate is his neighbor's property that he is crossing. And they are the servient owners. He is the dominant owner as the holder of the non-possessory right. Now, Francis, if you move out of that house and you sell it to somebody else, do you still get the right to cross their land to access that lake?
Me personally?
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't live here anymore.
And would the new person who lives there get that right? When you moved in, did they tell you have this right, or did you negotiate that yourself?
A little both. I took it out of it and just used it. It's now can provide my solution. I have to wait for parties because there's multiple parties in that.
So there's two ways you can have one. One is a pertinent, and one is engross. Most of these agreements and most of these most easements that we see are based on the person's ownership of land. So we have to dig a little into Francis's, which sounds a little bit complicated, but most pathways, most driveways, most rights of access are based on land ownership, right? So the driveway that I have and the easement that goes on this driveway between my two houses, if my neighbor sells her house, the next person who moves into our house has that easement on my driveway. It is attached to the land. It is not just that I like my neighbor Karen and allow her to do that, right? It's attached to whoever's the landowner. And that's why we can actually usually identify a piece of land, not just a person, that we think of as being the dominant owner or the dominant estate. So in this picture, right, of a right-of-way easement, the dominant tenement or the dominant estate is the estate that gets the benefit of the easement, and it comes with it. Sometimes they actually are related to an individual and it is not reported to a company, like a utility, and it has nothing to do with the person's ownership of land. Those are not usually right-of-way easements. But let's say it was actually just that Francis and his neighbor were on good terms and he negotiated with his neighbor that he was always going to be able to cross this pathway to access the lake, and it had nothing to do with Francis's ownership of the neighboring land. That would be called an engross easement. Because it's related to an individual and it is not based on ownership of land. At common law, in-gross easements were not permitted. At common law, easements were just supposed to be about ownership of land. And one of the main reasons for that is that we had really bad land recording systems. There was nobody who was keeping track of these things and writing down where they were and making sure we had records of who had rights in different people's lands and things like that. So the idea would be if you sell your land, if you have an in-gross easement across your land, and you go to get that, you're the new owner, you're the new buyer, you're going to come buy a piece of property. It might be very hard for you to understand if there's in-gross easements and figure out who those people are and who has rights if it's not written down somewhere. However, people felt like it's actually pretty logical to walk around and ask your neighbors to make sure to see if any of them have rights in your land. So not only was it a neighbor and tied to a piece of land, not only was it tied to a piece of land to be pertinent, it had to even be an adjoining piece of land. It had to border your land in some way. So your responsibility at the common law when you went and got a new piece of property would be to go around and ask all your neighbors and just double check and make sure there weren't any kind of unwritten or unspoken or like kind of hidden documents somewhere defining certain rights. Whereas an in-gross one, that would be really hard because who do you ask? Like everyone in the town? Would that even be enough? How do you know where Francis is and how do you track him down? So that's why it would be related to your land ownership.
And we'll talk about how that changed. Another way to think of easements is they're being affirmative or negative. And that is that the person who has this non-possessory right, we call it an affirmative right if we are giving them a right to do something on your land. If you are giving them a right to cross your land, that is an affirmative right. You have the ability to actually go on their land and do something. It is giving you, the easement holder, the right to do something on their land. A negative easement? Can anyone think of what a negative easement would look like?
To prevent someone from doing something on their land?
It's to prevent the landowner from doing something on their land. Because you don't need an easement to prevent somebody from doing something on your land, right? You're just as a property owner, that's just trespass, right? Like, I'm the owner of a piece of property, I can keep everybody off my land. I don't need to have special agreements with people that say you can't come on my land and do stuff. That's the default rule. So I need an affirmative agreement that says somebody's going to come on my land, right? I would want that to be an explicit arrangement, and I would give them an affirmative easement. Something that is much less common is what we call a negative easement, where you have an ability to stop the landowner from doing something they otherwise would have been able to do. So you have a non-possessory right in the land, but it's even kind of a non-occupancy right. You don't go on their land and cross it. You tell them they can't do something that otherwise they totally had an ability to do. The most common of these, blocking somebody's light. Blocking their view. They've got a river that flows through their land and you dam the river and stop it going from the river. There's usually a specific list by statute of which types of things are allowed to be negative easements. So you go look at the state law and you can see there'd be a list of like four or five things and they are almost always free flow of light, water, and views. Trust.
Are homeowners associations and rules they impose upon property owners in the neighborhood? Are those negative easements? Like, say you can't put a fence up?
There, we'll get to those next week. Those actually come in the category of covenants. But they are related to this idea. They're just a slightly different type of an agreement. Because those are more promises regarding the land versus giving somebody actually a property right in your land. And we'll see that there's a little bit difference to that. Other questions? We understand this basic contour. Pirate.
So is the right-of-way an affirmative easement?
Absolutely, right? Because the right-of-way is giving that person who crosses it, is giving the dominant owner, giving the easement holder the ability to do something on your land. If you have an affirmative easement, it means somebody is coming on your land and doing something. Or their stuff is coming on your land, like the sewage line is going through your land, the telephone wires are going through your land, but they are actively on your land, whether them or their representative or their stuff. A negative easement is very, very infrequent and not allowed at the common law, which is why states had to pass statutes specifically allowing them. There's a new category that is being recognized where we allow them for environmental protection that is slowly being recognized in all the states, where you could have a negative easement that tells somebody they can't do something on their land with the goal of environmental protection. But that was so unusual, states all had to pass a statute to make it happen, because there's no room in the common law to make an agreement like that, where you can make an agreement with somebody for environmental protection. Common law property doesn't allow you to do that. We had to pass statutes that enabled that to happen. Okay. Let's see. All right. So methods of creation. So the last thing I wanted to say, actually, I wanted to just point out something about the in-gross easements. The in-gross easements, so as I was saying at the beginning of this, like in the 19th century is when we really saw the growth of servitudes and of easements. It wasn't until even a little bit later that we saw the real growth of in-gross easements. Right? This was thought to be really unpopular at the common law because of how hard it was to track people down. But we changed our mind about that when we realized how useful utilities are. How really nice it is to actually have cable or, you know, sewage lines or telephone lines or electricity or what are the other things I have? Gas, right? Like all of these things, all of those are modern-day conveniences that we all agree are good things to have, but we don't, and we allow them come onto our property as non-possessory rights, right? We don't give the gas company ownership of our land by allowing them to put a gas pipe on our land. We can think of that, but their ability to do that is not based on the fact that they own land nearby, right? They're not one of my neighbors. So it's an in-gross easement that we have acknowledged kind of specifically this idea that utility easements are really beneficial, and it changed the common law at first just to accept utility easements, and now kind of perhaps because we're really a lot better at land recording than we used to be, opening up the idea of what other types of in-gross easements we might accept. All right, so how do you create an easement? The most common creation of an easement is an express easement. So, Arthur, that easement that the city has on your property, is that in writing?
Yeah, it was. It's no longer in effect, but...
But if somebody did a title search, they would have pulled up this easement and seen it on, in the records?
Yeah, because it was done with the town, so they were, like, all legible with it.
That's the most common way. The most common way is, like, actually, it's just written out between the parties. You have a neighbor who you want to access the lake. You go and you see if you can get into an agreement with them that allows you to access the lake. You want to access the boat launch. Maybe it's not the town. Maybe it's the neighbor. Maybe it's the town. Do they give you anything in exchange for that, you know?
Yeah, well, because my family purchased the road from the town, and I'm like on condition of that was that we had to allow the easement for the boat launch.
So this is usually done as part of a negotiation, and usually is reflected in sides giving concessions, right? Most people don't just say, ah, sure, please, use my land, I'm super nice, feel free to cross that whenever you want, build a road, shovel, I don't care. I don't care how many cars go by, it's fine. You don't usually do that. Usually you do that only if they're willing to give you money for that, or they're going to give you something else for that. There's some type of exchange. So most easements are paid for. Most easements... You might not charge the gas company because you might think, hey, I'm getting the benefit of gas being supplied to my home and it's worth it to me. But not always. Sometimes the gas company actually pays people when they first put in that easement. So an express easement is an easement that is explicitly put in writing, explaining the terms of the easement, who the different parties are, explaining how long it's going to last, explaining the scope of the easement. How big is it going to be? Is it going to expand over time? Is it going to change? And there's two ways we see this that the book talks about, either by a grant or a reservation. And a grant is kind of where you have the land in place already and somebody comes up to you and asks for you to write them an easement into it. And so you write a separate agreement that creates the easement. You sell it to them for, you know, $10,000. The reservation is what Arthur is talking about. The reservation is somebody is selling you property, but when they do so, they reserve a right to themselves in it. So the town sells them the road, but they write into it a reservation that reserves for them the easement to continue to cross it. The difference between those two doesn't matter legally. It's helpful for when we're reading cases to understand the background of how the agreements came about. But either way, we have an express agreement in writing. We're going to look at the terms of that agreement and interpret it to see what it says.
These are where it gets more complicated, and we'll see these, and we'll read these cases and go through them. Estoppel. So that's in writing. Then we have a whole category of easements that are not in writing, where the people did not explicitly agree to the easement, but we are going to bind the parties by an easement anyways. We're going to say there's different circumstances or implications that suggest that we need to have recognize an easement here for the sake of public policy. One of them is by estoppel. We'll see that estoppel. Have you guys come up? Where do you do estoppel? Supra. Nowhere else? Contracts. Right? It comes up a lot, actually. I mean, it comes up in a lot of different doctrines. It comes up in torts sometimes. It's just the idea. It's a principle that things have been going on for long enough that it would be unfair to kind of change the rules of the game. You can kind of think it's like everybody's been acting like there's a contract there. We're not going to suddenly say there's no contract there because everybody's been acting about it. You got the benefit of it. We should allow the other side to get the benefit. You can think of that in property, right? Everybody's kind of been acting like there's an easement there and relying upon that easement. You can't suddenly change the idea that there's no easement there, right? It wouldn't be based on ideas of fairness, kind of essential kind of common law ideas of equity and fairness. Implied easements. We have two types of implied easements. One is implied by prior use, and one is implied by necessity. And we'll see these both involve circumstances where the property was owned by one person and then divided up. In one case, the property is owned by one person and then divided up, and then we have this prior use that still is going through the two pieces of property. And the other is you divide up a piece of property and you leave the person totally landlocked. Right? Like, I sell you, like, 3 square feet of my backyard. It would be by necessity, you need an easement to get off of that 3 square feet, right? So there's got to be some pathway, right? You can't just have this 3 square feet that you could never access, right? So there's some implications here. Even if we didn't write that into agreement, by necessity, somebody needs to be able to access their property. Jamie?
Can you just go over the express easement by reservation one more time?
Yeah. Let me finish the list and then I'll do it. Prescription. Prescription is I don't know why we don't call it adverse possession. It's the same thing. Easements by prescription are easements by adverse possession. And we'll see that the rules are almost entirely the same with a couple different changes because we're going to have a different sense of kind of exclusive and open and notorious and things like that. We'll have to look at them a little bit differently, but it's the same principle. Somebody has been using it for a long time. And we saw an easement by prescription already in one of our earlier cases. Does anybody remember that? Right? What is it? What's it called? Van Valkenburg. Right? Where they had the pathway, they had gotten an easement, they had said, oh, we have adverse possession of a pathway, and they messed up, because they should have said they had adverse possession of the whole parcel. But they had shown that they had used this pathway kind of by Charlie's house and by the farm and stuff like that long enough, but they got adverse possession and had rights to use that pathway. That was an easement by prescription. Condemnation, eminent domain. We won't. We'll talk about eminent domain in a separate chapter, but just to kind of put it in your background ideas, that it is another way that you could get a pathway or to get an easement. We think of eminent domain as being a way that you can take somebody's property and pay them for it and use it for a public purpose, but you don't actually need to take their entire property. And we have a lot of actually utility easements that could be done by eminent domain. If you have a landowner that's not willing to enter into an easement, but it's going to mess up the whole utility line, it's going to mess up the whole railroad line to have, like, one person who won't agree, you can use eminent domain to make it happen. And we'll talk about that when we get to eminent domain, but just remember that on your list of ways that an easement might be created. All right, you want to grant versus reservation? Is that... Okay, all right, an express easement, an easement in writing. There's two ways you're likely to see this, right? The first is you and I are landowners, we're neighbors, you come to me and you say, it would be so much easier if I could create a path through your land instead of driving all the way around to the main road. I'm willing to pay you $10,000 for you to let me create a path through your land. That is an express easement that would be a grant. I would grant it to you, and we would sit down and we would nail out the terms of that in writing, and we would record it on both of our deeds.
The reservation is where I own a big piece of land and I'm going to sell it to somebody. And when I sell it to them, in the deed, I keep a little right for myself. I say, here's this property, I'm selling you this property, but I reserve an easement for myself to cross the land. It doesn't actually, the distinction here doesn't make too much difference because they're both agreements in writing, and we are going to interpret what they mean by looking at that written agreement. It's just to help you understand, sometimes our cases will say it was reserved, and sometimes we'll say it was a grant, just so you understand kind of the background of where they came from. The document itself isn't going to look too different, and the terms should be interpreted in the same way. Yes? Other questions generally about this list? Lovely. All right. Milbrook Hunt versus Smith. Of course, Allie is not here. What else? Ian. Yeah. Could you help us with this?
I was wondering if you could call me because last time you did, I wasn't here.
I have a talent. I was going to call an Allie today. See? All right. The time is now. Who owns this land?
You know the whole issue. I don't remember who exactly owns the land.
Here's a hint. Might be the case name.
Right. Smith is the one that owns it.
Yes.
And he wants to stop them from doing their Fox
News. Yeah. Do you know why he wants to stop them?
Against it.
Yes, and not only that, he wants to use this property as a nature preserve. So kind of having horses hunting through it is kind of not in keeping with what he hopes to use his property for. All right, so who is Millbrook Hunt and what are they doing?
They are something with fox hunting.
It is a club that engages in fox hunting, right? So they dress up. This is still a very active club if anyone wants to go check them out. They dress up in these outfits. They bring their hounds and their horses, and they come and they all over this area. This is not the only easement they have. They have easements across many different property owners, and about four or five times a year they do fox hunts. Okay, so what is the nature of their easement? Is this in gross? Is it appurtenant? Affirmative? Negative? Let's start with affirmative versus negative. Would you characterize this as an affirmative easement or a negative easement? Affirmative easement, right? It's giving the members of the hunt the right to do something on the land. And it's not telling him he can't do something on the land. All right, so it's affirmative easement. And would you say this is in gross or pertinent?
I think it's I don't know. If another company bought, like,
okay, how would we tell? How would we try and figure out whether or not it was pertinent?
Pertinent is just, well, engross is to the person, and pertinent is for the land.
So what should we look at to try and determine whether or not this looks like an engross or an impertinent easement?
The wording of the agreement.
The wording of the agreement? Anything else? That's not in the case. Just if you're trying to figure out if somebody's got an impertinent easement.
If somebody else would be a lot like if they buy the rights of hunt or something?
Not exactly. That just gives a transferability of easements, which doesn't answer to us what the easement is like. Arthur, you got an idea?
I just think that they're going to actually use the land.
That doesn't matter for ingress versus appurtenant. Both of these assume that you can actually use the land. Nate?
If it's attached to a piece of land or not.
If it's attached to a piece of land or not. And remember, at common law, you had to actually even be a neighbor. So the first, if you wanted to figure out if it was appurtenant, we don't have this in the case. I happen to know that they were a neighbor, but that's what you would do. You would go and look and see, do these people own land nearby? Are they actually an adjoining landowner? Because then their rights are associated with them, might be associated with them as a landowner. And we would think of the benefit then as being tied to the land. And whoever owned that piece of land would get the benefit. But the best way is to look, but sometimes you can be adjoining landowner, we still might want it to be engrossed. We still might really mean that it's, we don't really want anybody who lives next door to be able to ride their horses through our land. We only want the Millbrook Hunt to do that. So that's why the best evidence will be, as Ian says, looking at the agreement and seeing what it says. We don't actually have a discussion here of whether or not this is characterized as a pertinent or engrossed, but it sure sounds to me like it's being treated as an engrossed easement, an easement in the hunt based on who they are, not based on their status as a landowner, right? Okay, so here we have this easement. Well, how was this created? Express, estoppel, prescription, implication? It's an express easement. It is in writing. It was written and recorded. All right. Easements are required to be in writing to satisfy the statute of frauds. Why should we require easements to be in writing? Well?
So that you have one.
Well, like, so you know you have one, because you want to sell the place and not.
It's really about notice, right? It's about notice, and it's about the fact that easements are hard, or they're not clear from just looking at the circumstances to determine what an easement is or what the scope of it is, right? We might have trouble looking at just kind of the relationships of the parties and be like, how many horses are a lady allowed to bring, and how often can they do that, and, you know, was that forever? So something like this would definitely be the type of thing you'd want to have in writing, because it'd be hard to determine the contours otherwise. Easements have a kind of a hidden quality to it. We can't just look at the property and understand what the agreement is. We want them to be in writing. What is Smith's argument for suggesting that this is not an easement? And what does he argue it is instead?
He argues it's a license.
What would make it a license? What is a license?
A license is it has less the person who has the servient land has more power to like terminate it at any time.
Yeah. Do you ever give anybody a license in your land? No, you never have? Anybody give anyone a license in their land? Only Will and Hiram? No, nobody else? Will, what's a license you've given somebody in your land?
We've given like all of our neighbors permission to cross their backyard because it's easier to get to the beach.
Okay, you live by a beach?
I live a block away.
Nice. Do you give us all permission to cross your
Sure.
Nice. That is a license though, right? That was not in writing. Even if it was in writing. I think he can revoke that at any time. Kayla?
My father-in-law owns a lot of land in Cataract Town, and he'll let people go on to four-wheeler, dirt bike, or anything like that. Just some of his neighbors.
And he does, it's in writing, or he explicitly does so, or?
He just tells them it's okay.
Okay, I will hire you at one more.
Wouldn't it be a license to just open the door for your friend to come to your house and just let him hang there?
Yes. That's what I was going to say. All of you, I would guess, have given people licenses in your land. Right? Anybody you allow on your land with permission. The police, the pizza delivery guy, your friend that comes over to watch, I don't know, a movie with Netflix with you, right? Those are all licenses. Those are all you giving permission to somebody to come onto your land. And they are all revocable. Right? You do not have to let them stay. Your friend gets belligerent, you kick them out. They really want to watch some show you hate, you kick them out. Right? You retain that right to do so. You've not given them anything that allows them to remain there. We give licenses all the time, written and unwritten. Sometimes it's written, right? I could leave my babysitter a note that says, "Will you, come a little early and watch my kids today?" And I've given her a written license to come onto my property and use my land. Maybe I've given her a key to do so. Right? That's a license. Licenses are, by their nature, revocable. That's what a license means. estoppel, when we get to the estoppel, suggests that sometimes we give somebody a license and it's become, and it's ripened, and they've had it for so long, it becomes unfair to revoke it. But the argument here, we can see why the landowner wants to call this a license. The examples you guys gave were that were more formal were licenses too. We give people permission to, you know, hike in our backyard. We give, those are also licenses. And just the fact that it's in writing doesn't mean it's not a license. A license can absolutely be in writing. But he wants to argue it's a license because that way he can change his mind. He can say, this is revoked. Sure, you had the right to come and hunt on this property before, but no longer. I'm revoking that license. What are arguments, Ian, suggesting that it is not a license but was indeed an easement?
So the argument for the license is that there's a paragraph that says he has the absolute right to develop his land and then therefore he can relocate some of the trails. But they say that right is they can't completely exclude him from the property. And they look to the fact that the definite period of 75 years points to an easement license.
Exactly. All right, so here's some of the language that was in the document, the kind of way that the court discusses going back and forth. One is that it's for a period of 75 years. If a license is revocable at any time, it doesn't really usually make that much sense to give it an explicit period. That sounds more like an easement, because easements have a definite period, or they're either perpetual or have a definite period to them. You also had this language paragraph 6, right? The hunt deserved an absolute right to fox hunt on the land. Okay, that sounds like a pretty strong right that they had that feels a little bit more of a property right than a license. But then we have this final paragraph, right, that reserves to the grantor the absolute right to develop his land, which includes the right of redirecting the trail. Now, this one kind of feels a little bit like both, because in some ways, it suggests that the trails are supposed to always be there, and that they always have to have some level of access, and it's just giving the landowner the ability to shift those trails while still accommodating what the needs of the easement are. But the language suggests he has the absolute right to develop the land. I mean, what if he paved this land over entirely, and now it was no longer suitable for fox hunts? Is that permissible? I don't know. It's not really clear. It's not really clear kind of how. So we have kind of an easement agreement that has a lack of clarity in it, which is why, you know, it makes it to the court to start with. But the court says that this is an easement. And that means that it's not revocable until it expires. We'll cover at the next week or next class. We'll cover some of the other ways an easement might end, and it is a kind of a definite property right that retains in there. Now, something that makes property rights different than contractual rights is the fact that they are tied to a piece of property and not a person. So we could have had kind of a contract. And that would have looked more like a license. You could have had a contract that was between Millbrook Hunt and the previous landowner, whose name I don't remember what it is. The previous landowner, Millbrook Hunt, could have had a contract that gave them the right to hunt on their land. But by making it a property right, you make it a right that's tied to the land. And therefore, when the property is bought and sold, the right remains in place. Right, so this is a difference we see. They are actually kind of rights and duties that are tied to the land itself and not to the individuals. So the individuals could come and go, and the land should remain in the same place.
So the only way for him to get rid of this easement is to wait the 75 years.
Anything else you think you might be able to do?
You could breach it, just the loss of the
easement. He could breach it. I mean,
he could make it pay over the land.
He could pave over the land and make it like a, yeah, maybe. Charlie?
If Hunt was breaching their easement, going out to his property, that there was not especially applied to them through the easement.
What's that? What happens then? What is that? What would we call that?
He's ultimately breaking their stop. I'm breaking their easement, the rights period.
Okay, first, a couple things. Just to get at what Don's saying, so do they have to wait? Is waiting 75 years their only possibility?
Yeah,
Probably. Their other option is to try and enter into an agreement with Millbrook Hunt. They could probably, you could probably buy them out or something like that. But legally, like, there's not any kind of justification for him breaking this agreement other than kind of trying to negotiate with them and trying to get rid of it. Now, Charlie's question about, now, what if Millbrook Hunt violates their easement terms and they kind of go places they weren't supposed to, or he builds a new path but they take different ones? They, at that point, are trespassing. Their rights are only confined to their rights that they have within the easement agreement. If they go beyond what their easement agreement says, the landowner has a suit against them for trespass and for any damages or nuisances or anything like that that we might find accompanying that. Jesse?
I was confused by the court's use of the word permanent.
Yes, I hate that in this case, actually. I was wondering if that would bother anybody. I think that so they have this, in the very beginning they say easements are normally permanent. I think that is misleading. They're quoting something else, but easements do not have to be permanent, and this one isn't, right? You can have a term easement. I think they're saying the default, if you do not say that your easement is for a specific amount of time, the default is that easements are perpetual, that they last forever. However, and so I think that's why whatever they're quoting, some treatise or case or something that they're quoting, describes an easement as tending to be perpetual, but it doesn't have to be. And all the time, we have easements that are shorter duration. Tim?
So what kind of, I mean, maybe the language of the easement, but tell us, what would Smith have been able to do, what if he said, okay, you can hunt foxes here because I can't stop you, but I still don't have to let you break horses or dogs, or you can't wear guns, or no one can wear red on my property.
Yeah, so it would have to. You're right. We'd have to look at the easement agreement and see what the contours of it were. And if the easement says you are allowed to conduct the traditional fox hunts that you've been doing for the past 20 years, it would be pretty hard for him to change the rules about what colors they wore and what kind of. But he could definitely have something about the scope of the easement, right? And this, we'd all have to look to the easement agreement and what it said and how natural it is. And we'll see some other cases that interpret, like, how broadly we can read an easement agreement. Generally, we allow some leeway in kind of a natural evolution of an easement. Kind of like, let's say most pathways used to be for horse-drawn buggies. And cars are actually a little bit wider, so you need a little bit wider pathway for modern evolution of transportation. We interpret easements to allow that kind of modern evolution and widen it a little bit. Would it mean he could suddenly bring 100 horses on when they only brought 50 horses on? Probably not, because it would have had more intense impact. But that would all get into kind of the details of their particular agreement and how the wording was.
And then what else would Smith have been able to do can he trash their trails when they're not there, like for his trails too?
Yeah, he can't. So you can, as the servient landowner, you cannot interfere with the dominant landowner's use of their land. So he doesn't have to maintain the trails. He can use them for other things, but he cannot interfere with their ability to fulfill their easement. You can't put up a gate. You can't leave tacks on the ground that you think the horses might step on, right? All of those would be impermissible interferences with their easement, which they have an established legal right to.
Could he do all that stuff if he just allows them to move it?
I'm not sure what you're saying.
Like,
he can't interfere with their ability to fulfill their easement. The agreement allows him to change where those trails are, but it doesn't allow him to, like, prevent the horses from coming on or to, you know, lay traps for them or anything like that. He can't spray the place with poison, right? Like, all of those things would be him preventing the easement holder from exercising their property right, and that is not allowed. He could try and be creative and do other things that might discourage them, but not to the extent that he actually interferes with them exercising their property right. Hira.
I'm not sure what the court means when it's talking about the Smith having actual and constructive notice of the easement. I understand the actual part. I don't understand what constructive means exactly.
You guys don't come across the constructive notice. We'll see it actually more when we get to covenants. You'll learn explicitly about the idea of constructive notice. Actual notice means that he went and got the deed and he saw that there was an easement recorded there. He had actual notice of it. Constructive notice, we'll see pop up next class or maybe next week when we talk about covenants, has to do with the fact that sometimes you can actually look at the circumstances of the property and tell that there's an easement there. So it probably is that there was actually horse trails going through it, that everybody, and then maybe there were signs posted. You know, there was something else other than the deed itself that gave him notice that there was something going on there. Jesse?
Is that what they're looking at in the next case that they had funding, so they had constructive notice that there was funding running through their land?
Yeah, exactly, right? So there's some things we think of actual notice as being either from the document itself or because somebody has actually told them what is going on, and then constructive notice is a little bit more by implication, that you can tell from the circumstances what's going on. All right. Let me do this case, next case really quickly so we can move on. All right. Here we see an idea of things that arise by implication. So, right, so Milberg Hunt just says we have express easements. They're mostly very clear cases, but sometimes it means we've got to actually look at the language of the easement and try and figure out what the parties meant. There's a kind of, I hope people didn't get too distracted, there's a little bit discussion of a bona fide purchaser. That is something that is covered in Chapter 8, and that we just don't have time to do, but if you're curious about what the heck they were talking about, you can go back and look in Chapter 8 to find the discussion of the bona fide purchaser and what that means. Another thing I wanted to point out is there's a category of easement that this book doesn't talk about explicitly, but does come up, that's something that we call a profit, or sometimes called a profit upon the, which is, I speak terrible French, so I'm not sure what that means. Anyways, but an easement that we call a profit is an easement that actually gives somebody the right to collect natural resources from your land. These most commonly are things like you have the right to go hunting on somebody's land, or you have the right to collect firewood from somebody's land, maybe you have the right to pick berries from somebody's land. They're all like a type of easement where you have actually an affirmative right to go on somebody's land and do something. But what you're doing is extracting natural resources, game, wood, berries, something, water. Maybe you can go to their well and fetch water. Those are all called profits. And there's a reference to them there. I bring them up because sometimes it's on the bar. But it's a very kind of clear just subset of easements. All right, Van Santy Royster. This one we need a drawing for. Right, and this is how we see often things that arise by are different types of easements by implication. They often arise based on one landowner and then the land getting divided up. So if you see that, if you see one landowner and then the land getting divided up, you should always start thinking to yourself, oh, I wonder if there's something going on here, one of our implied types of easements. All right, so Bailey owned all three of these lots here, three adjacent lots on the south side of 10th Street and in Kansas. Here's what those houses look like today. Very nice little neighborhood, but the diagram's more helpful for our purposes. Bailey's house is located on, I can't explain the numbering, but Bailey's house is located on lot 4. And she built a sewer line, right? So she builds her house here, and she builds a sewer line that goes through all these houses and out to the street, to the main public sewer line, right? So she builds a sewer line that goes through all these places, and then over time, she kind of sells off all of the different pieces of property, and each new house that gets built up connects to what is a private sewer line connecting to the public sewer line. All right, so why is there a case here? What happens to Van Sant's property? Yeah, it's Christian. Yeah, gets flooded with sewage, right? He's at the end of this line. So he is getting the sewage from lot 4 and lot 20 coming to his. So he has these sewage problems. He's like, where is this coming from? And it's like, how could this just be me? No, it's not just me. It's my neighbors as well. It is the first time that he knew that the sewage line from his house was also carrying the sewage from his two neighbors. This was surprising news to Van Sant. So the question is, can he prevent his neighbors from having an easement across? So this is what they're arguing, right? They're arguing they have an easement across his property. So notice lot 4 has an easement across both lot 20 and both 19, if we grant it. An easement for the sewage, to use the sewage line to flow their sewage across those two pieces of property. That is an easement. It is an affirmative easement, right? Then we also have lot 20 having an easement against across 19. Royster is not complaining about lot 4. It's just like Van Sant. bringing suit, saying, I don't want the sewage from lot 4 and lot 20 to come across my property.
Does his lot 4 own the sewer line if no one else built it first?
Who owns the sewage line is unclear. I think it's I think it is lot 4 because they built it first, right? So if they think it, so what is the easement here? The easement is for having the line itself and then having the sewage flow through it. So they built it. They built this kind of this what looks like an easement, except for they own the whole property. So they just built this sewage line. As now suggesting that it's an easement means that they have the responsibility to maintain it. So absolutely, Van Sant could bring a suit against them to say, you know, you were supposed to be maintaining the sewage line, and you didn't do a good job. It's got to be a bigger volume or something. But he doesn't just want that. He wants them to not pump their sewage to his house at all. He wants them to, I don't know, build some new line that would go out each of their houses this way and then, like, connect up here or something like that. But you can see, because the public sewage line doesn't go along 10th Street in that way, it is pretty hard for them to figure out how else they would connect up their sewage lines. The key thing here is that all of these three properties were owned by one person. It was never put in writing. So when she sold off the different lots, she never mentioned. We do not have express by grant or by reservation. It would be a normal thing to have an express easement by reservation here when she sold off the different lots, if she had written in there, and by the way, you can have this lot 20, but just so you know, I'm holding on to the easement for the sewage line that runs through the property. She never mentioned that. Okay, so instead, we look at whether or not it falls into one of our implied easements. Implied easements fall into two categories, implied by prior use and implied by necessity. Which one does this look like to you? Oh, okay, yeah. This is tricky about whether it should be in necessity because people think of sewage lines as being a necessity. Most of our necessity has to do just with whether or not the person can get off the property. The idea would be you don't actually need a sewage line by necessity. You could put in your own septic system or do something else for the most part. Okay, this is by prior use. When we have an easement implied by prior use, I'll just show you very quickly. Here's the things we need. And we can talk about it more next time. You have to have one piece of property that was held in common ownership and was used, right, for the process. And then existing, apparent, and continuous use when the conveyance was made. And the use was reasonably necessary. So we don't really find this to generally be kind of falling into our category of strict necessity, but we do see that there was an existing sewage pipeline that was there, was used for the benefits of the property when the conveyances were made. We're going to imply it by prior use. Here's, Justin, we really want to ask this. The tricky thing is whether or not we would qualify this as an existing, apparent, and continuous use when you have a sewage line under the ground. And they said, well, you knew there was a sewage line there. You knew it was flowing through your property. You're kind of on notice. And so, like, whether or not this is apparent is a tricky one. But they say it's apparent enough because we know kind of common, kind of modern-day convenience means sewage lines, and we know it kind of is going to run through our neighbor's property. Make sense? Some sense? We can start. We'll start with this one next. We'll go over it again next time when we do the implied by necessity.